Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
The Port Authority of New York, New Jersey was founded in 1921. Its portfolio includes airports, marine terminals, bus stations, bridges, tunnels, and real estate, including the World Trade Center. It's everywhere in the New York metropolitan area, and its name is familiar to most people. But I'll bet that few residents of New York or New Jersey know the authority's history or understand what it does. Mobilizing the Metropolis, How the Port Authority Built New York, by Philip Mark Plotch and Jen Nellis, published by the University of Michigan Press, aims to fill that gap in public knowledge. It also looks at the Port Authority to extract some useful lessons about how organizations charged with solving governmental problems can win support and engage opposition. I'm Rob Snyder, Manhattan Borough historian, here for the New Books Network, and I'm talking to Phil Plotch, co-author of Mobilizing the Metropolis. Welcome, Phil.
How you doing, Rob? Nice to see you, hear from you.
Good to be talking to you. Deep in the acknowledgement section of your book, you thank your wife for accompanying you on your research for this book, which included trips to container shipping terminals, cargo facilities, suspension bridge towers, trash incinerators, and the swamps of Jersey. It sounds to me like you put your wife through a lot. Why wrote a book that requires this kind of research?
That's a great question. I would say I'd start with curiosity. When you look around the region, I think it's important for people to remember that things just don't plop here out of nowhere. Buildings just don't plop up out of here or nowhere. There's reasons for congestion. There's reasons why highways are in certain places. People make decisions. So I've always been curious about this ties between New York and New Jersey. There's this competition. So I remember over the years, New Jersey tries to get the Jets. They do that. They tried to get the stock exchange. They don't do that. They try to get the Yankees. That doesn't work. They get the Giants. That does work. They try to get people, businesses. There's this always this competition, but at the same time, they so much need each other, right? So New York can't survive without the warehouses in New Jersey, without all those office workers coming into the city every day, without the manufacturing and distribution facilities. At the same time, New Jersey so much needs New York, right? It's that economic engine for the whole region. So they need each other, but they fight with each other. And that's playing out right now with the congestion pricing, where New York and New Jersey are not working together. So there's lawsuits that go back and forth because they can't figure out how to cooperate. Well, the real competition shouldn't be between New York and New Jersey. It should be between the New York metropolitan area and the Seoul and the Tokyo and the London and the Amsterdam, because we're a metropolitan area that competes with other metropolitan areas. So the Port Authority is a really interesting organization because it's regional. It's really the only regional body in the New York area. And what's good for New Jersey is good for New York. What's good for New York is good for New Jersey. And what's good for the Port Authority is good for the region. And the Port Authority has been trying for over 100 years to try to strengthen the economy of the region. That's been their mission. And they've done it in lots of different ways. Like you said, they built airports and they built tunnels and they built bridges and they built the world's two tallest buildings. They've built industrial parks. They've constructed a lot of important facilities to facilitate the movement of people and the movement of goods. And that is really the sort of the lifeblood of the economy in many ways, right? You can't have a strong regional economy without strong basic infrastructure that can move people and goods.
New York was already the biggest city in the United States. It was the biggest port. It was a financial capital when the Port Authority was founded in 1921. In what sense did the Port Authority make the city?
So if you look back what the region was like 100 years ago, so it was the manufacturing center of the United States and the manufacturing center of the world, in a way I think most people don't really remember or understand. When my grandparents came here a little over 100 years ago, they all worked in the garment district because most of America's clothes were made in this very small section of the United States, like between 34th and 59th Street. Most of the furs were made, the belts were made, the clothes were made. There's the manufacturing of radios, the manufacturing of electronics. It was done in New York. New York was kind of like the China of the early 20th century, where we exported goods and materials all over the place. So if you think about all the products that are coming in to manufacture these things, at the same time, where this central location where food is coming in from all over the world and then shipped out. So like on the west side of Manhattan, that is like the fruit center for the world. That's where the fruit's coming in, whether it's pineapples from the Philippines or whether it's wheat coming in from the heartland of America. Things are coming in by train. Things are coming into the port. They're traded here. So this is the center for manufacturing. It's the center for distribution. It's also the center for corporate headquarters because they want to be near all of that. It's the center for the services that are provided to them. The immigrants are coming in, right? So it's the economic engine of the United States, right? But the issue they had was congestion. It's not unlike the issue that we might have today. So most of the goods are coming in by port, by water, to the west side and the east side of Manhattan, and as well as to Brooklyn. But the other chunk of the goods is coming in by rail, and the rail is coming into the New Jersey. So if you take a look at a picture of what the port looked like in Manhattan and New Jersey, it's just rail yard after rail yard on Jersey City and Hoboken. And on the Manhattan side, it's one pier after another. Every single street has a pier. So there's this disconnect. So the goods are coming in by rail to New Jersey, and they're coming in and leaving by ship on Manhattan, and you have to get across. And that's really where the Port Authority comes in. Like, how do you connect that rail and the port facilities? So one of the things the Port Authority is supposed to do in the beginning was create this new rail tunnel that would cross the Hudson. It would connect the piers and it would connect the rail, but that never happened. Instead, the Port Authority was founded at the same time that there's this huge burgeoning of automobiles. And the Port Authority saw this opportunity to sort of shift from this rail freight to more of moving people and goods by vehicles, by trucks, and by cars. And
they took that. What values and expectations shaped the Port Authority when it was first founded?
So it was the progressive era. So the progressive era was notable for, first, its optimism. It's that idea that government could make a difference, that government can solve problems. I think now we're living in that sort of maybe that post-Ronald Reagan era where the government gets in the way. But at the time, 100 years ago, the thinking was that government can create, whether it's civic parks or libraries for education or infrastructure to move goods in a way that would help businesses and help people. And having government seen as helping businesses was considered a good thing. That now there's a resistance. Like, I don't know if you remember when Amazon wanted to move their second headquarters into Queens, 100 years ago, that would have been celebratory, right? There'd be parades. Amazon is coming to New York. Amazon's bringing thousands of jobs. But now it's, oh, why are we giving tax breaks to businesses? Why are we going to end up gentrifying a community? It's a very different city. It's a very different region than it used to be. And it's a very different era when it comes to how we think of government. So the progressive era, optimism was one thing. Helping businesses was something else. But also there was this sense that government could do things smarter and faster if they did things in a sort of a rational, scientific way. So government, hopefully resistance from political interference, would be able to look at a problem, develop some alternatives to solve that problem, and then figure out what the best problem was. And they would do that in a scientific manner, that it wouldn't be, oh, this is what's best for one community or what's best for another community. It wouldn't be, what's best for one political party or another political party, but they would do it in an independent way. And that progressive era thought about how you can create government institutions to do that. And the Port Authority was very special because it was the first public authority in the United States. There's over 30,000 public authorities now, which is crazy, right? We think about the Metropolitan Transportation Authority, there's water authorities, there's parking authorities. Every town and every community has some sort of authority now. And
if you think of people who are as ignorant as me about the Port Authority before I read your book, could you sum up its structures, its responsibilities, and powers for us?
Okay, sure. So I just want to continue on. So the Port Authority, it's independent because it's like a public corporation. So that means it's not subject to the whims of the legislature every single year about what money it's going to be getting. Instead, it's set up like a public corporation where, and this is how all authorities are now, where it determines its own revenues and maybe sets fares. So for the airport, it leases space to the airlines and it charges the airlines. At the bus terminal, it charges bus carriers to bring their buses in and out. So it figures out its own revenues and it puts together its own budget for its expenses and has an independent board. So the way the Port Authority of New York works is there's 12 commissioners and each governor appoints 6 commissioners to 5-year terms. And that was set up on purpose, so the terms are a little bit longer than the governor's so that they could be independent of the governor's. And the way the board is supposed to work is the board is supposed to independently decide what's best for the region. But over time, that's changed, where now the board is very much controlled by the governors of New York and the governors of New Jersey. And over time, the two governors have siphoned money away from the Port Authority. So for a long time, the Port Authority had so much money, that it was able to do things that nobody dreamed a government agency can do. So imagine today, if a government agency, so imagine if the MTA said, we're going to build the world's 2 tallest buildings, right? It's just a crazy concept to me, to think that a government agency could do that. But the Port Authority had so much money because of the revenue it was bringing in from the bridges and the tunnels. It said, we can do this. We can knock down buildings where there were 17,000 people working. We can clear that space. We can build the world's 2 tallest office buildings. We can build hotels because it had so much money coming in. So as a remarkable organization for that wealth, the power and the independence. So it was the Port Authority that decided they're going to build the world's 2 tallest buildings. The governor's, it wasn't the governor's original idea. So it's fascinating to think how powerful some of these organizations can be when they have the resources to do it. So there's some authorities, like if you think about the MTA in New York, where it doesn't have those resources and it's always begging for money. So it doesn't really get to make those decisions because whoever holds the purse string ends up holding the money. So over time, different authorities have more or less independence, really a lot having to do with the resources and if it can control its own resources or not.
You know, I was struck by your book's point and then the older book about a Port Authority written by Jim Doerr. How would you contrast your respective takes on the Port Authority and its importance?
So Jim Doerr is actually the one who suggested that I write this book. He was, I guess, in his early 80s, and we started to work together, but then he pulled out, and then he passed away suddenly. Jim Doerr is brilliant. And Jim Doerr, besides being brilliant, also had a sort of a different emphasis in his book. He looked at leadership. So he looked specifically at the leaders of the Port Authority when it was first created. There was an executive director named Austin Tobin, who started in 1942, and he lasted for about 30 years as executive director, which is unheard of today. Most New Yorkers know about Robert Moses, the head of the Triborough Bridge and Tunnel Authority, and all he was able to do in New York. Austin Tobin was able to do a lot on his side of the region, but in sort of a quieter way. He didn't have that arrogance, and he didn't develop the personal animosities that other people had, but he was able to take over the airports, build the World Trade Center, build the bus terminal, working a little bit more behind the scenes than Robert Moses did. So Jim Doig looked a lot at Austin Tobin, his personality, his history, and entrepreneurial leadership was sort of the big thing for him. So when you're running an organization like the Port Authority, you have to be thinking about how you're going to bring money in, because there was really no revenue source when it first started. The Port Authority had an advantage. It could issue bonds, and those bonds were tax exempt, and it could charge people fees for its facilities. But otherwise, it didn't get any money from the state or the federal government. So you had to be entrepreneurial. You had to figure out ways to raise money in order to build what you wanted to build, in order to expand, in order to provide the services that you wanted to provide. So his, Jim Doig's aspect of the book was, or aspect of the Port Authority was really thinking about that entrepreneurial leadership. Mine and Jen's, the book that we wrote, looked more about how the Port Authority was able to get what it wanted to by building coalitions, by working with other organizations, because any organization can't do anything on its own. It needs to work with lots of different people. Also, we had a much longer time frame. We go till about 2022 or so, and Jim's ended mostly, I would say, like the mid-60s or so. So ours is a 100-year book. His is more of a 50-year book.
You know, with regard to Austin Tobin, I was looking at his obituary in the New York Times, and the Times said that with regard to Tobin, the Port Authority was, quote, seen as the creator of many of the region's transportation problems because it catered with its tunnels and bridges to automobiles. Is that a fair criticism?
I would say you could say that about all the elected officials and unelected officials in the 1950s and 1960s who said, we're going to expand highways and we're going to neglect public transportation. We're going to rip up trolley lines. We're not going to be pouring the resources that the subways and the elevated lines need anymore. We're going to let the commuter railroads go bankrupt, those private companies. What the Port Authority did was they encouraged people to move to the suburbs. And at the same time, it was the private companies that used to own the subways in New York. It was the private companies that used to own the railroads in New Jersey and New York. And those all went bankrupt. And it took a long time before the government came in and provided enough resources. What the Port Authority did do as part of its deal to build the World Trade Center was they took over one small railroad called the Hudson and Manhattan Railroad, because they were getting so much pressure to take some of their excess revenue and pour money into public transportation. But if you want to be an entrepreneurial leader, you don't want to get into the business where you're going to lose money. So the Port Authority always looked to see if they could be revenue neutral or make money. So they got into the airport business because they thought they could make some money. They could charge airlines to use the airports. They could issue bonds to pay for improvements, and that the revenue they would be getting from the airlines and passengers would be making money. But I think what's really interesting to me is they got into the business of bus terminals because they thought they could be revenue neutral or make money. Now it's a huge money loser, right? Nobody makes any money from public transportation. But at the time, they calculated if you add all the money up from the lockers, because people are going to use lockers and they'll go to Macy's and they'll go back to put stuff in the locker. There's like nickels there. And the money you would get from the bus operators coming in and the advertising on kiosks and the stores and the bowling alley and the supermarket, you could actually make money on a bus terminal. Trouble is now that bus terminals lose so much money that anybody who owns a bus terminal is trying to figure out how to get away from that business as opposed to how to expand that business.
You write that the Port Authority won big, but also failed big. What are its biggest wins in your view?
I would say the wins and losses go together. So building the World Trade Center is a huge accomplishment. But at the same time, I think it was a bit of a failure. First, you ruined historical neighborhoods in Lower Manhattan. And it was built in a way that wasn't tied into the rest of Lower Manhattan. But at the same time, it's a success because all of the soil and the dirt that you dug up ended up turning into Battery Park City, the land for Battery Park City. And that's a huge success. And as part of building the World Trade Center, the PATH train was taken over. That's the old Hudson and Manhattan River. That was taken over. And the PATH train has led to huge renewals of cities like Harrison in New Jersey, Jersey City, Hoboken, and possibly Newark also. And that I don't think would have happened if the Port Authority hadn't taken that over. But at the same time, the World Trade Center was supposed to be this place where businesses from all over the world would do trade. That's why it was called the World Trade Center. And it was only supposed to be doing businesses for, only supposed to be places for people doing world trade. But that concept was antiquated and never really made sense when it was first started. So the building were a white elephant. They were empty for many years. It wasn't providing that economic impact it was supposed to have. Instead, it became really just two new office buildings. And it was competing with other office buildings in New York. And looking back on it, I don't know if it really makes sense for a government agency to build office buildings to compete with private office buildings.
Other big successes and failures that you can think of?
The Port Authority bus terminal is both a huge success and a huge failure. So nobody says, oh, I'm looking forward to going to the Port Authority. Oh, hey, let's go get lunch at the Port Authority, right? I don't even think the Port Authority should have its name on it anymore. It's such an embarrassment. But at the same time, it's one central place where buses are coming in, and that didn't exist before the Port Authority built it. There was a Greyhound bus terminal, there was a Trailways bus terminal. And I think the most important and the most misunderstood part of the port of the bus terminal is it's connected to the Lincoln Tunnel, which means that buses are coming in and out of New York without going on local streets. And that is just huge because just as many people take the bus from New Jersey as take the train. And you wouldn't want thousands of buses on the local streets. That just wouldn't work at all. So it means buses can operate much more efficiently. People can get in and out much faster. Buses are less expensive because of that. And buses are really important. I know there's a lot of people who are like train people, and there's a lot of people who are bus people, but New York needs both of them in order to survive.
You go into detail about the operations of the Port Authority, and you come up with a guy who's kind of an unappreciated hero in your book. And his name is Lou Gambaccini. Why is he so highly regarded in the Port Authority, and what can we learn from his career?
So it's funny because when you start writing a book, you put together an outline. And I did not have a chapter that said Lou Gambaccini. That just didn't exist. I didn't know anything about him. I might have remembered he was the first president of New Jersey Transit, but that's all I might have known about him. So he was the first president of New Jersey Transit. He actually started New Jersey Transit. He was a brilliant guy who worked at the Port Authority. He's never the executive director. He was always at the most the number two or number three guy at the Port Authority. He went from the Port Authority to work for the governor of New Jersey, helped set up New Jersey Transit, at taking its private bus lines and taking its bankrupt railroads and putting them together. And then he went back to the Port Authority. And what he saw was this need for coalitions, for bringing agencies together. He was a person who believed in public service, and he believed you couldn't get anything done by yourself. You needed groups of people. So one of the first things he did, he was heading the PATH system, was he brought different transit agencies together, because if you wanted to go from one part of the region to another part of the region before the internet, listeners, this is before the internet, it was really complicated. So if you wanted to go from New Jersey to the east side of Manhattan, where do you get your bus? What time is the bus? How do you pay for the bus? Where does the bus go? Oh, or do you take the train? How do you get from the west side where the bus and the train come in to the east side? Do you take the subway or do you take the bus? How do you pay for it? Are there discounts? What time is the last bus? How often does it run? There are just so many questions. And you would have to call multiple people. You would have to call possibly the Metropolitan Transportation Authority and New Jersey Transit. You'd have to call a private bus operator. Some people would have a shoebox full of schedules and maps. Other people would have like whole shelves full of stuff of these things, trying to figure out how to get around. So you had this idea that you bring them all together, but it didn't work. There was too much resistance, whether it was labor unions that resisted some of these things or agencies didn't want to give up their power. So he wasn't able to create this one central place. But what I really liked about Lou Gambaccini was he was undeterred And the Port Authority was undeterred. They gave him room to experiment. They gave him resources to bring people in. They gave him staff to sort of take his initiatives. And one of his big initiatives after that was ferries. So as the head of PATH, he knew that it was way too expensive to expand the PATH system. And he knew building a new train line would take decades. He knew you couldn't build a new bridge or a tunnel between New Jersey and New York. But he said, hey, we used to have ferries on the Hudson River. Let's get some more ferries back. And it took a couple of years. It took a lot of convincing, but he was able to get a new ferry started between Battery Park, which is next to the World Trade Center, and Hoboken, where New Jersey Transit goes. And that ferry service really started a whole new renaissance of ferries. So there's a lot of ferries now that go between Brooklyn and Queens, between New Jersey and Manhattan, between Manhattan and up and down the river and throughout the harbor. So that was one of his. But a couple of other things he did, which I think are great, was he saw this need for the transport agencies to get together when they're doing construction. So sometimes there's parallel highways. So in New Jersey, there's the Garden State Plaza. I'm sorry, the Garden State Plaza is a shopping mall. The Garden State Parkway and the New Jersey Turnpike are parallel. And each agency would be doing construction at the same time without talking to each other. So we said, oh, we should all get together and coordinate our construction. At the same time, he was once going from New Jersey to New York and he was driving and he wasn't sure which tunnel to take. He said, I'll just take the Lincoln Tunnel. And he ended up getting stuck for like 2 hours because there was no electronic sign that said, take the Holland Tunnel. So he said, hey, let's get all our agencies together, coordinate information. So what he did was he invited 15 agencies together, invited them to lunch at the World Trade Center. And when you invite people for lunch, you're going to get more people and they're going to be a little more amenable to your ideas. And he had this idea about bringing them all together, coordinating real-time information so that when one agency has a problem, it can disseminate that information to everybody else. We take this for granted now, but what he did was really a model for this multi-agency transportation information and using it to solve all sorts of problems. And he created this organization called Transcom, which is still in existence. And right now, if you use Google Maps, you're getting information that's coming in through Transcom. So it's telling you when there's a delay, it's telling you when there's construction, it's telling you when there's a lot of traffic or incidents. A lot of that information is coming through this clearinghouse that he helped create through his coalition. And this coalition building, it outlasted him. So E-ZPass, which most people east of St. Louis are familiar with, where we no longer have to wait a half hour online to pay a toll. Now we can zip through the tolls thanks to electronic tolls. That was through this coalition building that he inspired, where agencies get together. So there's not 15 different tags. You don't have one tag on your car for the Pennsylvania Turnpike, one tag for the New Jersey Turnpike, one tag for the MTA's bridges and tunnels. You have one tag that works on all of them. And this coalition building and Lou Gambaccini is really the person who inspired all of this.
You alluded earlier briefly to the fact that starting in the 1990s, the Port Authority lost autonomy to governors. And how did that happen and what were the consequences?
Well, I think it was triggered by Rudy Giuliani. So at the time, Rudy Giuliani had just been elected mayor and he beat a Republican conservative named George Marlin. And Rudy Giuliani hated George Marlin. And that sort of backfired on him because the year after Rudy was elected, George Pataki ran against Mario Cuomo. George Pataki was a Republican. And Rudy Giuliani supported the Democrat, Cuomo, Mario Cuomo, over the Republican. So the Republican, to get Rudy Giuliani back, puts George Marlin, Rudy Giuliani's arch nemesis, in charge of the Port Authority. So now Rudy Giuliani, the mayor of New York, he has this streak that we've seen in the last few years. It's a little bit of viciousness. It's a little bit of going over the top. It's a little bit of he's going to do whatever he can to get back at his enemies. He sort of takes it out on the Port Authority and makes the Port Authority look really bad. He talks about how the Port Authority is mismanaged, wasting resources, helping New Jersey over New York. And he had a point in a way, because New York is making a lot of money from some of the Port Authority's resources, like the airports and the World Trade Center. And it's subsidizing people who use the PATH train and who are using the bus. So the trouble is, when you look at it that way, sort of that one for one number, you forget that all of those people from New Jersey who are coming into New York every day, they are spending their money at Broadway shows. They're spending their money at spending their money at restaurants. They're making real estate much more valuable in New York. They're helping corporations in New York. They're helping corporations stay in New York. So it makes sense to subsidize that public transportation. But Rudy Giuliani didn't see it that way. And it wasn't a big deal politically to say, oh, let's help people in New Jersey because it helps us. So he really poisoned the water for the Port Authority. He made it harder for New York and New Jersey to work together. And what ended up happening was New York and New Jersey started to fight in a really hostile way, where the Port Authority board wasn't even meeting for a whole year. It slowed up projects like expanding American Airlines facilities at Kennedy Airport. Continental was trying to expand. That slowed down. And it all had to do with whether or not we as a region should be subsidizing some of the port facilities and expanding the port facilities. New York saw them as better for New Jersey. New Jersey saw them as sort of a regional resource, and that was really important for the economy. So the two governors couldn't get along, I think poisoned because of Rudy Giuliani. So it just slowed everything down and made it harder for the two governors to work. And then the governor started getting more active in where the Port Authority's resources went. So it became less and less the Port Authority deciding where its resources should go based upon some rational decision making, which was the whole idea. Instead, it was, oh, the Port Authority is a big piggy jar, and let's see what we could take out of it.
How does that lead into what was known as Bridgegate?
Well, what happened was the governor of New York, when he put in Rudy Giuliani's arch nemesis, got a lot of pushback from New Jersey. They wanted a deputy executive director to go along with New York's executive director. So what happened was, now all of a sudden, there are two fiefdoms with two staffs, with two senses of loyalty at the Port Authority. One, the executive director making decisions back in Albany. One, a deputy executive director with all the decisions being made back in Trenton. What happened with Bridgegate was, this New Jersey delegation was looking to pay back the Fort Lee mayor, who was not supporting Chris Christie, the governor of New Jersey, in his reelection bid. So what they did was, they said, we're going to create some traffic and we're going to make life miserable for people in Fort Lee. That was the New Jersey delegation. The New York delegation, the New York side of the Port Authority didn't know what was going
on. For our international listeners, Fort Lee is at the western end of the George Washington Bridge crossing the Hudson River.
Correct. Yeah. So they closed off some entrances from Fort Lee onto the bridge. That backed up cars for miles. It made it harder for ambulances and fire trucks to get across town. And it was all just, we're going to punish the mayor of Fort Lee because he's not supporting Chris Christie for governor. Did not make anybody look good. Didn't make New Jersey look good. Didn't make the Port Authority look good. So it's sort of amazing that the Port Authority was one institution thinking about what benefits the region. Now it's these two fiefdoms looking out for what's best for our governors.
Just before the conclusion of your book, you write that only time will tell whether the Port Authority can, quote, rebuild its capacity for bold regionalism, or if it will remain a diminished, if still reasonably functional, steward of regional mobility. What would a better Port Authority look like, and what might it achieve? What needs to happen to make a better Port Authority?
Well, New York and its economy has really relied on great transportation, whether it was canals in the 19th century, railroads in the 20th century, subways, whether it was the bus terminal, airports, highways. The ability to move people in and out is really important for businesses. And it's important for residents too. Like, people move from Kansas City and they move from the South and they move from Singapore. partly because there's great air service, right? And also partly because they can get their Amazon goods 4 hours after they order them. If all of a sudden our ability to get around the world is diminished, if our ability to get around the region is diminished, and if our ability to get goods in a timely, inexpensive manner is diminished, that hurts the New York region. It makes it less competitive when we want to attract people and we want to attract companies. So the Port Authority and New York together have to figure out a way to ensure that we can keep that up. And this is not an easy thing because we continue to grow and the demand for travel continues to grow. So if you think about our airports, so in the 1950s, we had three major airports with about 10 runways. And today we have three major airports with about 11 runways. So we've barely built anything. The airports are shiny and they're new. I think the terminals look great at Kennedy Airport and Newark Airport and LaGuardia. But the trouble is that we can't get any more planes in than we could have decades ago. We've been fortunate because the planes get bigger. So we're also fortunate that we've improved our runways and built new taxiways. But if we can expand those airports to accommodate more people, we're going to have more delays. Flights are going to get more expensive. And it's going to be a less attractive place for people to live in a global world. Even if people can do 90% of their work on Zoom, we still have to get around and goods still have to get around. And we still want people to fly in and out every single day because it drives the economy.
Two big problems in our time, and I'm wondering what you think they mean for the Port Authority. One is the changes wrought by the aftermath of COVID in commuting and land use patterns in New York City and the region. How does the Port Authority deal with that?
Well, one thing that's surprising is how the number of trips by cars hasn't changed all that much. And I haven't looked at the numbers yet, but I'm guessing the number of trucks has probably been going up, right? Because we have all these small trucks coming in and coming out, stopping by our house twice a day with delivering food and delivering packages. So that hasn't changed that much. What has changed clearly is people aren't going to the office 5 days a week. It's more like 3 days a week. So the demand for the bus services and the demand for the transit services is going down. It also means that the office space isn't needed like it once was. So the Port Authority just built millions of square feet of new office space at the World Trade Center, not necessarily needed in a way that people thought of 10 years ago. So there is definitely a glut of office space. And the Port Authority doesn't help that by sucking away some of the older office space. New York is going to have to change, right? We're going to have to see a conversion of some of that office space into something else, whether it's entertainment or residential or hotels. And it's not an easy transition. But New York is sort of amazing how it has been able to overcome so many things. And the history of the Port Authority shows that. Like, we went through a depression, which hit New York hard. We went through the loss of manufacturing, which hit New York hard. We went through a suburban flight, which devastated cities across the country, but we came out okay. We went through the September 11th terrorist attacks, which hit the Port Authority as much as anybody else because it was the Port Authority's headquarters. It was the Port Authority's real estate. And all of a sudden, the Port Authority's facilities became the number one target. The George Washington Bridge, the seaport, these bridges and tunnels they're vulnerable and they're just so important. So the Port Authority was able to deal with that. So if you think about all those things that New York has been able to overcome, I think we're going to be okay overcoming this pandemic. I don't know about St. Louis. I don't know about Cleveland. I don't know about Detroit, but people are still flocking to New York. And I think we're going to be okay, but the Port Authority has to step up. The Port Authority has to ensure that we can still continue to move people and goods because it's the lifeblood of New York.
What about the climate crisis and rising sea levels? What might the Port Authority be doing about that?
So the Port Authority was set up to help the economy of the two states. And like I said, there's a lot more competition than cooperation. The Port Authority has a lot of expertise, engineering expertise. It has the ability to undertake projects in both states. So the Port Authority can be given a role in power let's say, wind power or generating power. It could be given a role in trying to ensure that technology across the two states works together. And it certainly can be given a role in climate change, because our transportation facilities are so vulnerable. If you think about in the New York area, Newark Airport is on Newark Bay. The Kennedy Airport is on Jamaica Bay. And LaGuardia Airport is on Flushing Bay. Those are three places that are so vulnerable. Transportation facilities are typically built where you have like a train yard, where you're building things. It's often built on cheap, vulnerable land. And the Port Authority should certainly be taking a leading role in not just helping the transportation agencies think about climate change, but also thinking about how the whole region can think about climate change.
One last question. There are now port authorities charged with running ports and solving regional problems all around the United States and all around the world. What can they learn from the story of the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey?
I would go back to collaboration and cooperation with your regional partners and thinking about how you can leverage your resources. And those resources could be money. Those resources can be intellectual capital. The resources could be sort of expertise and entrepreneurial leadership. And to think about how you can work together with the other organizations in your region. So in New York, the Port Authority is by state and it has different modes of transportation. So instead of just thinking what's best for buses, what's best for trains, what's best for airports, if you can think about transportation as an integrated whole, because goods will be flying in, they're going to go onto trucks, they're going to go onto local roads. If you just think about what's best for that one city or what's best for that one airport or one facility, you're missing out on the whole picture about how things move. I think we learned a little bit about supply chains during the pandemic and how important they are and how sensitive they are to any kind of disruption. So it's really important for a region to be thinking sort of holistically, which goes back to collaboration and working with your partners.
This has been really informative. What are you doing next?
So I work at the Eno Center for Transportation, and that is an independent nonprofit think tank in Washington, D.C. But because of the pandemic, I can live in my home in northern New Jersey. And one thing that I've been doing, which is really, really fun, is it's an election year. So I decided, wouldn't it be great if every week we can write about a different president relating to transportation? So if you go online to Eno Transportation, Eno, T-R-A-N-S, you read about George Washington and lighthouses, Thomas Jefferson and the Erie Canal. And we're working all the way up around Inauguration Day to Joe Biden. And because we know that the last one in the series is either going to be a current president or a former president, right? But can I just tell you, do we have time to tell you who my favorite person is?
Go ahead.
So I've been writing a bunch of these, and I love learning about like American history and transportation because they're like tied together. But the last person I just got to write something is a guy named Charles Bolden Jr. And he was a Black kid growing up in the early 1960s in South Carolina. And he wanted to go to the Naval Academy. So he writes to his congressman, Senator Strom Thurmond. And if anybody knows Senator Strom Thurmond, there's no way he was going to nominate some Black kid to the Naval Academy. So he tries the whole congressional delegation. They all turn him down. 1962, early 63. He writes to the vice president of the United States. So the vice president can nominate somebody. Not the president, but the vice president. Vice president, he starts this correspondence back and forth. And then the vice president gets a promotion. You probably remember. Something happens to the boss, right? And the president can't. But the president, Johnson, is able to get a Chicago congressman to nominate Charles Bolden. So Charles Bolden goes to the Naval Academy. Charles Bolden becomes a fighter pilot, test pilot. He ends up becoming an astronaut, going back and forth to the space station. He ends up heading up NASA. So Charles Bolden is going to write about President Johnson and his space initiatives, that's travel, right? And that personal connection he had about how the President of the United States helped this kid get into the Naval Academy, become an astronaut, and then head up NASA.
That's wonderful. I'm Rob Snyder, Manhattan Borough historian for the New Books Network. I've been talking with Phil Plotch co-author with Jen Nellis of Mobilizing the Metropolis, How the Port Authority Built New York, published by the University of Michigan Press. Thanks very much, Phil.
Thank you, Rob. Always a pleasure.